Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Welcome. This is Toby Mathis.
And Jeff Webb.
And you're listening to Tax Tuesdays, where we're bringing tax knowledge to the masses. So happy Tuesday. It's another fantastic Tuesday. And we're already getting hit with a whole bunch of questions, which is always fun when we get right in and immediately get hit. I'll get to those in a second. Send your questions to taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. That's tax. You could see it right there. Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors. And then that's where we answer the questions. These, and during the Tax Tuesdays, we grab questions that we, there's usually hundreds of them. So we grab ones that are kind of duplicative and you say, hey, here's something that kind of stumps us sometimes. Sometimes it's something that everybody needs to hear repetitively. So we'll grab it and it's asked in a different way. But whatever the case, we grab those and then we answer them. If it's just general stuff, we just answer it. If you're a platinum client, we're going to answer it. If you're not a platinum client and you ask very specific things to you, then you just need to become a platinum client. It's actually really easy. It's a whopping $35 a month. And you can ask all the legal and tax questions you want. This is fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help educate. We've been doing this. We're well over 100 shows. I forget what exact number this is. We're well over 100 shows that we've done. And for those of you guys who have been on before, know we try to keep it around an hour. We've been saying that for years. And usually ends up being a little bit over, like sometimes 2 hours, sometimes an hour and a half. We're going to try to keep closer to the hour mark just because some people don't appreciate going long. We have a whole bunch of questions that have been asked already. But before we get to those, let's go over the opening questions that we're going to answer tonight. I may be inheriting a timeshare that I'm sure has fees associated with it that I do not want. If I end up getting this, how do I figure out the details to get out from underneath it? So timeshares just really comes down to inheriting a timeshare. What if you don't want it? How do I transfer ownership of a property used as a rental in my husband's name to an LLC under my real estate C-Corp? Is it possible to refinance a rental property, then transfer title? We'll get into that. If I purchase a Ram pickup with rear passenger seating, can I deduct the full amount of my taxes? I have two subchapter S corporations, also known as S corporations. You'll usually see us just called an S corp. Is all of the funding for legal costs to start the business tax deductible? Do we get our full amount we put into starting this business refunded during tax time? Interesting question. I'll dive into that. We'll go over what I know Jeff's already. Jeff just lost another piece of his hair. Which is the best way? We'll go over what our deduction is and how it works. Wait, someone says, Jeff, are you the whistleblower? No, that's not even me. That's somebody else.
I'm actually calling from Washington.
You're calling from Washington. But why does your caller ID say Schiff? Which is the best way to fund an Airbnb, cash or mortgage, if money is no object? I love that. Money is no object. Which is the best way to fund a new business that's mainly based on one piece of equipment and needs just one staff? I want to figure out what that equipment is. Is there a rule of thumb to follow when deciding whether to capitalize their expenditures made to renovate a property? For instance, would new flooring, lighting, plumbing, built-in cabinets, et cetera, be considered expenses or capitalized expenditures? Interesting question. I am a resident of Oregon. I'm carrying several notes on houses, that just means loans, that I have sold, and I'm carrying the paper, so owner finance. I am considering changing my residency. Would I have to continue to pay Oregon state taxes on these notes? Interesting question. Where should property management business be formed? Wyoming or where I reside, Corp, S Corp, LLC, disregarded. That's interesting. Good questions thus far. Can you have both a private foundation and a public foundation? The private foundation's 5% donation to go to the public. Do distributions from state-specific disregarded LLCs to a Wyoming holding LLC cause a taxable event? Good question. We'll answer that one too. Is it too late to rent out your house for 14 days under the tax code? We'll answer that one too. We'll get into what they're actually referring to. Hi, I'll be 70 in April of 2020. Since the new tax law or the new law allows us to take the first required minimum distribution at 72, then I don't need to take RMD this year. So that RMD, by the way, is required minimum distribution from a qualified account like an IRA or 401k or defined benefit or something, not a Roth. What is the requirement by the IRS in order to qualify for a real estate professional? We've gone over that a few times, but it never gets old. And it's something we need to keep going over because people keep sending me stuff that's wrong. I love accountants, but sometimes they're wrong.
Make you a little crazy.
And I like the IRS, but sometimes they're wrong. They actually have said, whoops, we made a mistake on this one. So they've done some opinions and they've had some court cases where they actually did it wrong. And they're pretty good about saying we got it wrong, but there's still bad stuff floating around there. We'll go over that. What is included in calculating a gain loss on sale of a single family rental, a single family home rental? Broker commission, seller paid closing costs, renovation, dot, dot, dot. So we'll go over all that. Jeff loves that type of stuff. Does all revenue in a partnership have to be declared as income by the partners, even if some is left inside the company, so you don't distribute it? Yeah, we'll go over all that. Before we get into this, we have at Anderson, basically there's actually five levels of classes. The level five is an executive retreat. But I just want to kind of go over these with you guys because a lot of you folks aren't already Anderson clients, haven't been to our workshops. So I want to invite you to a bunch of stuff, and I'm going to give you free stuff because that's how we roll, and then I'll show you some really cool stuff. So the first one is Tax and Asset Protection Workshop. Quite often we run this one as a special where we will give you an invitation where you can come. It's a three-day class on tax and asset protection. We really focus in on real estate because it's a huge risk asset, but they're all over the country. You can go to our website at andersonadvisors.com and look at it. You'll see that there's pricing on there. If you reach out to us through the Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors email, then you're gonna Susan and Kendall grab these and we'll absolutely comp you in because I said so. Level number one class also is the Infinity Investing Workshop, my little favorite workshop that I love to teach because I love teaching it to younger people. And it's not sexy. It's how to get rich slow. How many Zeus? Oh my gosh. It's easy. You remember things very, very well. Somebody's pointing out the Infinity Investing Workshop. We're going to be doing one on April 18th, I believe, that you will all be invited to for free, courtesy. And it is a live stream, so it won't be something where you have to fly out. You'll be able to stay home and listen to the recording as well. It's a one-day class. I would encourage you to watch and also get your teenage to young adult kids or friends involved. And the reason that I say that is because in 20-something years of looking at tax returns, I know who makes money and who doesn't. And I know what consistently you've been doing this a lot longer than me, Jeff.
Right. Close to 30 years.
Close to 30 years. And are there things that people that make money all the time pretty much do that those that like to blow themselves up do not?
Yeah, there's different things. And it's anything from really paying attention to where your money's going, setting up your structure properly.
I'm going to make it really easy for you guys. We're going to learn what an asset actually is and how to identify it and how to avoid buying liabilities with liabilities. You're also going to learn to actually use mathematical equations when functioning, and we'll be able to cut our costs. Just to give you an idea, if you have a stock account with $100,000 in it, chances are you're paying about $4,800 in fees that you may not even be aware of, and we'll show you how to eliminate those. Yeah, it's absolutely a hoot. And it is, again, we use stats, we use the information that's available in the public record. You can go out there and see who makes money, how they make it, and how you can avoid being the gambler in the casino, and you can learn how to be the casino. So Infinity Investing Workshop's absolutely fun. And it goes hand in hand with everything else you're already learning. So we work with a lot of awesome affiliates, a lot of great real estate companies, and this will go hand in hand. It'll just give you some mathematical equations on how to build passive income sources to where the idea of infinity is you never have to work a job again, and how to figure out what that number is and how to how to calculate it. So which of these are free? It's the Tax and Asset Protection Workshop and the Infinity Workshop. Structural Implementation Workshop, for those of you who actually put a structure in place, if you've gone through one of our courses, if you have corporations, LLCs, We'll teach you how to run them correctly, bookkeeping and all the compliance that you need to do. I am teaching this level three workshop, this TaxWise, and I'm going to give you guys an offer this next, actually 2 days, I think it is, Thursday and Friday. It has been sold out for quite some time, but there's still availability on the live stream, and I'll show you how to get that if you want to watch it or watch the recording. And then the nonprofit workshop I'll be doing, I think in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, that is also sold out, but there's also a live stream on that one. But if you like doing philanthropy, if you want to learn how to run a 501c3, it's a lot of fun. But I'm going to focus on the TaxWise, because TaxWise, you're going to learn basically 30 plus strategies on how you can save. And I always tell people, walk away with three of them and you're going to pay yourself several thousand dollars a year. It really does come down to about $1,000 an hour of planning. And we're going to give you the tools so you can do the planning, so you can save yourself a lot of money. It is obviously the 6th and 7th is sold out here. We're completely at capacity. We have quite literally about 600 people on the live stream, and we have room for more because it's a live stream. So what I'm going to do is, just to kick off 2020, if you want to have the TaxWise courses, we do a beginning of the year and end of the year. So all we're going to do in 2020 is two. We're going to do a beginning of the year and end of year planning, and both of those, to have both of the live streams and the recordings, is $247. You're going to go to this little ABA link, TW2020. It'll take you to a login page. It's not on the portal. A lot of you guys realize that you can, if you're a platinum, you can go to the live streams for $197 each. So this is going to be cheaper. It's $247. It's going to take you to a little page where you just fill it out. It's basically two for one. It's $247. You're going to get the live cast and the recordings, and you're going to get access to both the beginning of the year and the end of the year. Guys, if you spend some time, and I'm not going to blow smoke up your skirt, if you spend some time with us on taxes, you'll absolutely put money in your pocket. I guarantee it. If you don't save, I would just say at least $1,000 to $2,000, even a basic person, I'll give you your $247 back. How about that? You can just say, hey, the facts matter is you wouldn't be making any money. I could show pretty much anybody with a pulse how to save money. And that's just because there are so many little nuances that people don't see that we're able to do. So absolutely join us. Instead of paying a lot of money, you're going to pay a little bit of money. You're going to pay $247, and you're going to have both recordings. And then we're going to get right on over. All right, let's jump into the questions. So feel free to jump on that. And that's the last you're going to hear that. All right. I may be inheriting a timeshare that I'm sure has fees associated with it that I do not want. If I end up getting this, how do I figure out the details to get from underneath it? So, Jeff.
Well, and many people have run across these timeshares that they're cheap to get into, but expensive to keep. And they're very hard to get out of. So I know one way of doing this is to disclaim your bequest, your inheritance. Mm-hmm. And by doing so, you're saying, I don't want this.
Yeah, it gets kind of fun. So whenever somebody passes, they have an estate. And so unless you had something in joint tenants with right of survivorship, or you had a paid on death, or you owned something with, well, I guess it would have to be joint tenants. I can't think of another situation. It's going to be part of a separate estate. So if I'm joint tenants with right of survivorship, we both own something together. And if one of us has a liability, the other party is responsible for it, and vice versa. But if I pass, and let's say Jeff and I own something as joint tenants, then Jeff owns it, period, and he's on the hook. If I am if I'm a child of somebody and I don't own that as joint tenants, usually joint tenants with right of survivorship is something between the parents or husband and wife. Big issue is, don't do this with your kids, because your kids' liability can come up and take something away from you during your life. I see in certain cultures, mom will put their son on their bank account, and then son gets a divorce, and the next thing you know, mom's account's getting hit by ex-spouse, which is never good, or son does something funky, ends up and we've actually seen this a few times in bankruptcy. It's an available asset of the bankruptcy estate, so they'll grab it. So you don't do that. But let's just say that it's a situation where you don't own it joint tenancies. It's maybe a child. Mm-hmm. Then there's actually the estate. And before it's transferred to you, you have the ability to disclaim it. And so if you disclaim it, then you're out from under it, so to speak. But if you use it, you lose the right to disclaim it in these situations, especially with the timeshare.
Yeah. And the time to disclaim is actually fairly short, isn't it?
Depends. You usually have 9 months after somebody passes. to get everything done. If you probate it, then it's at a state by state, but it's usually about 120 days that they would have to make a claim. You're just saying, I don't want it,
right,
because it's too costly. I don't want to get this time, this timeshare that's just going to weigh me down. Now, if it's an asset, like, you should have it valued. And let's say that you don't want to pay those costs, but you could sell the timeshare. The estate should sell the timeshare. So now you're under the clock. It's usually, again, about 9 months. You might want to list it for sale and see if somebody will take it. And if they take it, then you're off the hook again. You just sell it, and then that asset would be part of the estate. It's distributed to the beneficiaries. If you're one of the beneficiaries, then you would get the cash. But it's kind of tough. And then you have this weird forced heirship laws that exist in, like, Louisiana and Puerto Rico. This one may force you to take something, and then you're fighting off the liability. And I actually saw this once in Puerto Rico, where somebody was being force-fed a house that was underwater with the mortgage. And they had to, it took a little bit of paperwork to get out from underneath it. So you do not put your head in the sand and say, I'm not going to do anything. You still want to get rid of this. You still want to get rid of it. And it usually is going to require either a disclaimer. And let's put it this way. If somebody leaves you as the primary beneficiary, and then it goes to another sibling or an uncle or some other relative, then it goes to them. And right, then they have to disclaim too.
Yep.
So it's not easy peasy. I wish it was. All right. How do I transfer ownership of a property used as a rental, and it was in my husband's name, to an LLC under my real estate C corp? Is it possible to refinance a property, then transfer title? What say you, Jeff?
Here's how I would do it. And you may have another idea, Toby, but I would actually transfer title to my spouse. It's or gift it to my spouse. It's a tax-free exchange. Mm-hmm. And then she can just dump it into that LLC, and she can contribute it to the LLC under the corporation.
Mm-hmm. If you are in a community property state, then it may not matter. You don't have to do it.
Right.
If you're transferring it to an LLC, and this is where it gets really important. So an LLC is not a tax designation. There's no such thing as an LLC to the IRS. They want you to tell them how it's going to be taxed. So an LLC could be taxed as disregard it, ignore it, and tax the owner. It could be taxed as a partnership. It could be taxed as an S corp. It could be taxed as a C corp. It could be taxed as a trust. It could be taxed as an individual. It could be taxed as an S. Again, you're telling the IRS when you're filing its SS4 how it's going to be taxed. So when you say, I'm taking a rental property, I'm putting it into an LLC, first question is, how is that LLC being taxed? If it's disregarded or a partnership, then we don't really care. You're not going to pay any tax on that transfer. And yes, refinance the property before you transfer title. 99% of the time, because they will not finance it in an LLC. They will not finance it in a trust unless it's a portfolio company. If it's a traditional lender, they want to finance it in your name, and then you're going to put it in the LLC. If you're worried about a due on sale clause, or you're concerned, I would use a land trust maybe as something to hold title, and then make the LLC the beneficiary. When they say under my C corp, hopefully that's just a management company, because I would never put rental property in a C corp.
And I was going to say a couple things I saw was, apparently this rental property is not being protected by an LLC right now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think it needs some kind of protection. But yeah, I putting in a real estate C corp would not be my favorite place to put it by any means.
Yeah, and somebody says, hey, what's an SS4? So an SS4 is a document that you file to get an employer identification number. So whenever you set up an entity, or if you want to be a sole proprietor and you want to operate in a different name, then you ask the IRS to give me an employer identification number. It's like a social security number, but it's for a company. So you're just going in and asking them, hey, you know, so if it's an LLC, for example, there is no such thing as an LLC. So you fill out the SS4, you might say partnership. Or if it's going to be disregarded, you'd actually click other LLC disregarded. You just write disregarded on it. And then you'd give the tax identification number of whoever it's going to go on, whoever return it's going to go under. So if it's disregarded, for example, here, it's the husband and wife filing jointly. You could give either person's social security number. And the IRS now expects to see the profit and loss from that rental on that individual's 1040. That's what they're going to look for.
Right.
If there's a C corp there, again, I wouldn't have the real property in a C corp. There's a number of reasons why, but C-corps, you lose the long-term capital gains rate as an individual. You lose the ability to have flow-through losses. You lose the ability to have real estate professional status where that LLC, the real estate is offsetting my other taxes, either as an active participant or a real estate professional. There's so many things. And then if you take it out of the C-corp, it's a taxable event. So we want to make it really easy to, you know, to refi again. I want to pop it back in my name. It's not taxable if I have it in an LLC tax as a partnership or as a disregarded entity. So to answer your question more clearly, assuming that LLC is really you and your husband, or in my husband's name, so it's you and your husband, then I would more than likely at LLC's disregarded or taxed as a partnership. And then, yes, you can refinance it to put it in there and transfer title. There's no taxable event. You could take it out. And if you're in California, for example, there's no Prop 13. It doesn't reassess the value as long as you're the owner. So we see that all the time. And people that do real estate, they know that all the time. But what if kids want the timeshare, then they keep it and they have to pay all the bad stuff? That was on the previous question. If I purchase a Ram pickup with rear passenger seat, by the way, Rams are awesome. Michael Bowman, my partner, You know, Michael, is this up in Salt Lake City where he lives now. And we're driving around. He just got himself a Rebel, a 1500. So those things are awesome. Can I deduct the full amount of my taxes? I have two subchapter S. You want to whack this one?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the Ram because the 1500 starts at just over 6,000 pounds.
They work. I think there's only the club.
And I bet there's something totally worthless welded onto the bottom of that sucker to get that over the 6,000 pound
threshold. Why is that 6,000 pounds so important?
So if it's over 6,000 pounds, it's considered a heavy truck, a heavy vehicle. And at that point, it's subject to the Section 179 expense. It's not limited in how much you can depreciate each year. Mm-hmm. And even though Congress raised those amounts.
English. Means you can write the whole thing up.
Correct. See? Now, one thing you got to
bring along a CPA. You need an interpreter with the CPA.
All right. But you got to keep in mind that if you're going to write the whole thing off, you got to be using it 100%
for business. Otherwise, you're going to pay tax on the personal use, and the IRS gives you a wonderful schedule that says based on the value. And Ram's like a cheap Ram right now. Like let's say you bought a new one, it's $50,000.
No, I was looking at the prices of the trucks. Wow.
And well, I should say that's a cheap one. That's one that's kind of pimped out. You could probably get one for $35,000 if you really wanted to.
Okay.
But if you had personal use of that, they're going to say, what's the lease value? Let's say you used it 50% for business, 50% personal. Then they may say the lease value of that is $10,000 a year. And since you used it 50% for business, even though your business wrote the whole thing off, you're going to have to pay tax on 50% of the lease value, which is half of that $10,000. So you're going to pay tax on payroll of $5,000. That's how that works. But your company got a $35,000 deduction. Mm-hmm. So you have to balance those. Somebody says depreciation on a Ram. Yep. Makes it look a little more palatable. So can a single member LLC tax as a C-Corp create and own a 401k for passive investing? It can sponsor the 401k, but you are the investor. So it's still your account. Yeah. So the business sponsors it and you are the participant. So, but yes, it can. Somebody asked an interesting question. This has nothing to do with the Ram. So don't get mad at me. People always say, hey, advance your slides. But I'm looking to start an IT staffing firm. I want to leverage after-tax Roth retirement accounts like Rob's. Well, that's not really an after-tax. So you're thinking about doing a Rob's transaction with a Roth or 401k to minimize tax burden. You're going to have to use a C-Corp. So he says, I'm trying to avoid double taxation with the C-Corp. What is the best strategy step? DJ, I might be looking at an opportunity zone, first off, because you may never have to pay tax if you hold it for 10 years. And you can defer tax for a good 6 years now on anything that was taxable. So, for example, if I sold something, had some capital gains, I could push that straight in. I wouldn't have to pay any tax this year. I pay tax in 2026 and never pay tax again as long as half my staff is in an opportunity zone. Or if you did a Rob's transaction, you have to be a C-Corp. And C-Corps aren't so bad. C-Corps are actually really good because you have a 21% tax bracket. And if you take the money out, you pay tax at your long-term capital gains rate, which can be zero. So it always depends on when you take it out. Long answer to a simple question, right? Yeah, so that you have a bunch of options. What I would say is you need to talk to somebody. Just raise your hand to Susan and she'll get you hooked up with a professional advisor who'll give you your options. All right. Is all of the funding for legal costs to start a business tax deductible? Do we get our full amount we put into starting this business refunded during tax time?
Okay. For the first part of the question, we talk a lot about startup costs. Actually, these legal costs to start your business are what we call organizational costs. Mm-hmm. So you have startup costs, you have organizational costs, and both of them allow you to deduct up to $5,000 or expense up to $5,000 in the first year.
In the first year, if it's over $5,000, do I lose it?
No, you don't lose that $5,000. You can still amortize the rest of it over the next 15 years. But once you hit $50,000 in either of those categories, you lose that $5,000 and you're amortizing the whole amount.
So if you spent legal costs of $30,000, ugh, you would take five and then you take the 25 and divide it by 15 and you get to write that off.
Correct.
If it's 100, then you would just take the 100 and divide it by 15.
Now, the second part of this question, do we get our full amount to put into starting the business refunded during the tax time? And I hear this fairly often. You have to understand IRS is not refunding any money that you have not paid directly to them.
Yep.
But I think what we talk about is you can reimburse money that you paid for starting up the corporation to yourself. So the corporation's reimbursing you. It's not IRS or any other government authority that's refunding you money or reimbursing you money. Mm-hmm. And you're also, you're using these expenses. So if you generate income, it's going to lower your tax liability.
Yeah. So here's the big one. First off, can you get the full amount refunded? What you can get it is you can have it returned as a reimbursement from the company.
So, correct.
So yes, let's say that I spent $10,000. Your company can give you $10,000. It's going to get a deduction of $5,000 plus the other $5,000 is going to be divided by 15.
Right.
That's something I have no idea what the number is. And you're going to $400 and some dollars a year. So your first year, it's going to have a $5,400 and some odd dollar deduction. And if you make $5,400, you pay zero tax. And you got the money back in your pocket. It's not a refund like a tax credit. Tax credit's dollar for dollar. So you could absolutely potentially do that too. I don't know if there's another way to look at this, but no, you just get a deduction. So I'm going to make it really easy. What Jeff said.
What the accountant said.
What the accountant said. He actually said it. You don't even need an interpreter on that. Did a really great job on that.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let host Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. Two in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
All right. Oh, and by the way, Jeff, you said there's startup expenses too. You get $5,000 for startup, which is the investigation into the business.
Correct.
And $5,000 for organization. Organizational costs are filing fees, lawyer, accountant cost, all that. Startup fees can be just anything that you spent checking out your business and getting ready to go into it.
Correct.
So you can have both. Which is the best way to fund an Airbnb? Cash or mortgage if money is no object? So
here's my way of looking at this question. It's, can I get a mortgage low enough that I can invest my cash elsewhere to get a better return? Mm-hmm. I don't see this so much as a tax question. Now, you do have to figure out, you're going to have some interest on your mortgage that you're going to be able to deduct, and that's going to go into the calculation. Mm-hmm. But I look at this more as a return on capital question.
Everybody kind of does that. You know, here's the thing. If my return on my money, mm-hmm. and it always reminds me of Buffett. He always said, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And he goes, no, that's not right. It's a bird in the hand might be worth two in the bush, depending on the length of ownership and the return. It was something like that. I just remember laughing. I think it was his last year conference, but it was, what is the best way, to use your money? So if I am getting 10% consistently on my money and I can get a mortgage for 3%, then I'm better off to borrow somebody else's money at less. The problem is that's pretty hard to do. Like, you have to have some consistency. If you're sitting on cash, chances are I'm not going to tell you to get a mortgage. If you can buy it for cash, do it. Now, here's the thing with Airbnb. whenever we see Airbnb. It could either be a trader business or it could be a rental. And what dictates that is whether the average daily use, or the not the average daily use, the average rental period per guest,
correct,
is 7 days or less. If it is, then it's a business. You're a hotel, and it's active income, which means you're going to get hit with self-employment tax and your ordinary tax rate. If it is not, if it's over that 7 to 8 days or more, then it's going to be passive. And the reason this is important is you should look and see whether, if you borrowed money, whether that interest is going to keep you from having taxable income. If that interest is going to make you operate at a loss, then you don't get to use it because it's passive, then I probably wouldn't do it. If it's going to create an offset active income, then I might, because every dollar that I'm saving, if I'm paying that, not only is it the interest rate that perhaps I'm able to make a spread on it, but it's lowering my tax bracket as well. And I might say, hey, I'll take that action just for the tax savings. So it's a little bit of a calculation you do. I wish, like, I'm not going to sit here and play with the numbers live. It's a facts and circumstances. What I'd be doing is looking at your situation saying, hey, here's your option. Here's the spread. And if you can get cheap money, but that cheap money that you pay to somebody else is lowering, like, for every dollar that I'm paying them, I'm getting 50 cents of tax benefit. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden I have to factor that into how much I'm actually paying.
Correct.
And if I have a nice dividend stock portfolio that's paying me 3%, maybe I'm selling some options on it and I'm getting another 2 or 3%. So I'm making a very easy, no sweat, 5 or 6%. Maybe I'm doing this. And maybe it's going to make a much better situation, because all that money that I'm talking about, by the way, when I'm doing the dividend, that's long-term capital gains too. That's tax. Like, even if it was a push, I may still be coming out ahead because I may be paying 3, but I make 3. But my 3% that I'm paying is offsetting active income and saving me 50 cents on the dollar, or 50%. But the money that I'm paying in dividend is being taxed at 20%. So I make a little 30% spread there. You actually have to do the numbers.
Yeah, the one thing I would say on this, if you are going to do the mortgage, you need to make sure that you're putting enough down on the property where you are not paying fees that you don't need to be paying.
Mm-hmm. See, these guys are fun. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on here. All right, I'm going to have to get to these questions in a little bit. You guys asked a ton of them, but they're not related to this. That happens once in a while. All right. Which is the best way to fund a new small business that's mainly based on one piece of equipment and needs just one staff?
I found this question kind of interesting because, first off, I was very curious as to what this one piece of equipment was. Also, if the staff was somebody that they were going to have to hire to work the equipment. Mm-hmm. And what were they doing with the equipment? Are they renting it out, or is it some type of manufacturing? So a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm. Here's the deal. Whenever I have a new business venture, and if I'm going to use equipment, I'm going to be very, very tempted, depending on what my outlook on it, because most people get one piece of equipment with the eye towards getting 2, 3, 4, or 5. You want to establish business credit in that business. So if I'm going to fund a new business and I need to establish business credit, I'll tell you exactly how I've done. I've given it money. I take that money and I put money into a CD or a very conservative account, and I pledge that as security on a line of credit, so that business starts to build up its own credit profile. That line of credit I would use to buy that piece of equipment. If I do this right, I may either generate a active loss, which I can absolutely take depending on that piece of business, or I may not be having to worry about paying any tax. So for example, if that piece of equipment is $100,000, I may start off at the gate taking a $100,000 loss. And if it's $179,000, I don't believe I can take that as a loss against my personal. I would carry it forward. But let's say I made $100,000 off that piece of equipment, I'd pay zero tax on it. The staff member just tells me I have to be careful about taking out, depending on how many hours a week they work, I may have to worry about discrimination rules. And so if I throw a 401k on this, or if I have a very aggressive cafeteria plan, a 105 plan, health, dental, things like that, I may have to allow them to participate. So I'd want to factor that in. But I would actually be looking at funding it with cash, with an outlook towards using that cash as security to start the credit profile on the company. So when it comes around time to buy new equipment, I now have a credit profile. It's going to take a couple of years. I'm just going to warn you, but I've literally done this on two different businesses, and this is the way you do it. What you end up with is you have a credit history then on that business, and eventually they don't require the security. The piece of equipment is a security. If you have really good credit and you have depending on the type of equipment, if this is heavy equipment, for example, then you may be able to co-sign and allow the business to start building up its profile with it being the main lender, or how would you say it, the debtor, and you as a personal guarantor.
So one of the things we've talked about is separating the equipment from the business. Let's assume, like you said, it's a piece of heavy equipment. It might be a mobile crane or something of that nature. If we were to do that and rented the equipment back to the business, so we have a company that only has the equipment in it, where would you put the staff?
It depends, because the staff, there's liability with having staff. So if you have a really expensive piece of equipment, you probably don't want the staff with the equipment. I'd have them in the operating business, and I'd have the rental income coming over from the equipment. Usually it's going to be an LLC, so let's just call it equipment LLC, leasing over to a management company, and the staff would be employed by the management company. You have discrimination rules regardless, and the discrimination rules say any companies that I own more than 50% of, it's all going to be treated as one anyway for discrimination rules.
So for benefits, it's not going to matter where you put them.
Right. Some people think, hey, I'm going to, I'll have employees over in company A, and I'll be the sole company and employee in company B. I'm going to give myself a whole bunch of reimbursements and a bunch of benefits, insurance, et cetera, and I'm not going to provide it for the other company where all the employees are. It doesn't work that way. They call you brother, sister, corp, and they're going to throw you in together. Or at any organization, doesn't just have to be a corp, but that's what they term it, a brother, sister organization.
So when you were talking about how to lease it and building the credit and all, does separating the equipment from the business change how you would do that, or would it work the same way?
No, you would use that particular business and you'd have to show its income. So let's just say that this wasn't the only business, that I actually had a main company. Mm-hmm. So for example, let's say I had a dental office and I was buying equipment over here. If I was going to create a separate entity with its own credit, I have to show an income stream. So I would have to figure out what the fair market value for that rental is. I would lease the equipment to my main company, and I would start documenting. In credit, you always say it's cash, collateral, or credibility, the three C's. I've been doing this for years, so it's just what you call it. You either have to have a bunch of cash, so you put money into it, put it in a CD, use it as collateral. You have collateral, which is there's the piece of the equipment. Sometimes you're using real estate. Sometimes you cross-collateralize. And then there's credibility. The credibility is you until the company is old enough to stand on its own two feet. It's like a teenager. You'll have to co-sign in the very beginning. And some people get really mad. They say, I set up a company. It's got an 80 done in Bradstreet. Why do I have to co-sign? Because there's no history. That's it. I just got approved to borrow by having the LLC pledge the asset property. Should I have applied as the corp that owns the LLC? Not necessarily. But see, this is case in point. So this is somebody asking this online. You guys can't see the question, but so you got approved to borrow by having the LLC pledge the asset, the property. So it's cash, collateral, or credibility. Which area does that fall into? The collateral. And so you're cross-collateralizing. So the LLC may have got it, and this is exactly what we're talking about. Or if I wanted another company to build its credit, because it's the one that I want to have access to funds or equipment, then I would build it in that particular entity, in which case then I would just have to pledge the other asset. You just say, hey, I'm going to use this as security. Again, it's like being a co-signer. So you always have to be very direct about which company is going to build the credit and why. So if I'm going to have a leasing company, like I want to have a whole bunch of equipment and I don't have to worry, I don't want to worry about my employees, you know, filing a discrimination case or slip and fall happening. I put a bunch of water on the floor and somebody, let's say it's the dental office, they trip and fall or there's a malpractice claim. I don't want my equipment to be in the target field. I don't want it to be there for someone to take. Then I'd separate it out. Good question, though. Somebody has asked, do the discrimination laws apply if you're 100% owner of a C corp management company and you get benefits, and you're also 100% owner of an S corp that manages that may have employees? Yes, it does. Again, they look at it if you and anybody else own more than 50%, I think it's 50%, then any of those entities are considered brother, sister.
Right. And a really good example of that is I can't set up a defined benefit plan in that C corporation where I only am. and exempt all my other people who are over my S corporation. I'm going to have to, whatever I contribute for myself, I'm going to have to contribute for the S corporation employees.
All right. Somebody just answered, I'm going to have to, so this says company A is a doc and has employees. Company B is owned by spouse and company A is also employed by company B. Company B has a 401k with only the doc and spouse. Best employees, company A be covered. And I'm just going to say real quick, husband and wife.
Yeah.
They're considered one person. So yes, you're going to have to cover it. That's a great example. And this is the prime example. So when you do that, as much as we would love to be able to say no, you're going to have to say yes, but then there's ways around it. You just have to be aware of it and you can put in there vesting requirements. You can put in there different classes of employees. So sometimes, for example, you'd say only certain level of employees are covered. And you'd, you know, like sometimes there's safe harbors for like 401ks. What you could do is you just have to make it available to them. So you may have your own 401k and you may have to have a 401k for the other employees. And you just meet the safe harbor, which may be a 3% match or something right. like that. You actually work with a 401k specialist. And they put it together and make sure that you're copacetic. You just don't want to pretend like it's not there because you don't want to lose your deduction. All right. Here's a good one. I have certain questions that I see come in and I actually get kind of excited for. So when I saw this one, I was like, hey, this is pretty cool. Is there a rule of thumb to follow when deciding whether to capitalize or expense expenditures made to renovate a property? For instance, would new flooring, lighting, plumbing, built-in cabinets, et cetera, be considered expenses or capitalized expenditures? So first off, Jeff, could you please explain what they're asking?
Okay. So we have a rental property, perhaps, and we're renovating, maybe tearing out the kitchen. And this actually has several rule of thumbs. The first and easiest one is if each item comes on an invoice that is less than $2,500, you can expense that.
So what's the difference between an expense and a capitalized?
So a capitalized expenditure is going to typically be depreciated over the life of that asset. It might be a 5-year asset, 7, 15, as long as 39 years for commercial mm-hmm. property. Mm-hmm. So it may take a long time to, we used to see typewriters for $35 get depreciated over a number of years and mm-hmm. So the first way to expense that is, like I said, you get the invoice, and it's kind of important to work with your contractor, if that's the case, that he's billing that countertop and a sink maybe separately to keep it under that $2,500 invoice. Mm-hmm. What you don't want is a bunch of $2,500 invoices that say renovating kitchen, because mm-hmm. the IRS is just going to accumulate those and disqualify it.
Well, okay, so what Jeff is saying,
go ahead.
Paraphrase. If it's something that's an expense, you get to write it off now. If it's something that's a benefit over the useful life of whatever it is you're attaching it to, then it's called capitalized. And they spread it out over the useful life of that structure if it's a piece of real estate. So when you say renovate a property, I'm assuming it's real estate. It's not a bicycle, right? it's not personal property. So if it's commercial, it's 39 years. If it's residential, it's 27 and a half. So you're that sucks.
Right.
So if I put in flooring, lighting, plumbing, built-in cabinets, et cetera, I'm spreading it out over that lifetime. Certain cabinets, by the way, are over a shorter period of time, like if it's in a kitchen. But I think if it's in a bathroom, then it's over the – they have some funky rules. But the whole thing is if it's expense – and Patricia, by the way, you're hitting it. There's people that are responding live to me. And they're saying, what about bonus depreciation? We're going to hit that. You're getting it right on. And somebody says, what about the de minimis safe harbor? Aaron, you're absolutely right. We're going to, you guys are hitting this before we even get there. What you end up doing, the central air conditioning repair, it's like, you guys are smart. You guys are already hitting on this stuff. So if you don't want to capitalize it, then it needs to be considered a repair, or you need to be in a safe harbor where even if it would be possibly something that's benefiting the useful life, it's in an area where the IRS can't contest it. And so what Jeff said is absolutely right. If it's less than $2,500, the IRS can't contest it. You're in a safe harbor. They agree not to audit you on it because it's less than $2,500 and you get to expense it. So I get to write it off right now. Now, what about the stuff that I don't get to write off right now? it's over a long period of time. But that's the default, that 39 and 27 and a half years. If you decide to break it down, somebody nailed this already. I think it was Patricia. You get a star. If it's less than 20-year property, you can write it off all in year one. And 20-year property means like flooring might be 7 years, lighting might be five, plumbing, depending on the type of plumbing, could be 15, seven or five. Built-in cabinets, I've seen those. Again, if it's a bathroom, they're probably going to say it's part of the building. If it's anything else, it's probably 5 or 7 year property. I forget which one.
And one of the big changes was HVAC was made to be a shorter life.
HVAC, I believe you can actually do under 179.
Correct.
So you could. So there's an equipment amount of $1 million a year you can write off immediately. In HVAC, I think security systems, but these are on commercial property. These aren't for residential property.
You're right.
So, but everything else, you don't need that, because if it's anything else and it's less than 20-year property, you can write it all off in year one. And so you're looking at this going, well, how do I get there? Well, you have to actually break down the pieces. It's easy if you're doing a renovation because you have the contractor. So like Jeff said, is absolutely 100% accurate. But you're going to do something called a cost segregation, and that's a change of accounting election, and it's a form 3115 that you file. And it says, by the way, I don't want the default. I don't want to write this off over 27 and a half years. I want to break the pieces down into 5, 7, and 15 year property. And if you're wondering what is an example, I grabbed a few examples, but these are things that you would have as that would increase the value of the business, that these would be broken down into pieces. So for example, when we look at there and you see additions, bedroom, bathroom, obviously deck, garage, porch, patio, those are all additions. Those would probably be 27 and a half, 39 year property, depending on what type of property it is. The porch patio might be 15 year. The lawn and grounds, those are almost all 15 year properties. Miscellaneous, those are probably going to be closer to like the new roof. What are those, 15 year property now?
The roof also got an exemption, but I think, again, that's for commercial properties.
The roof is, yeah, but it also has a shortened life.
It does have a shortened life.
It used to be the whole, but I think it's going to be covered underneath your bonus. Central vacuum is probably going to be five. Wiring upgrades, what is wiring usually going to sit under for you guys?
It actually depends on what it's for.
Yeah, it depends on whether it's can be removed. I know that there's some funkiness. Right. It might be five, seven. Seven is probably going to be under 15. But either way, you have the right to write the whole thing off. Satellite dish is probably five. Security system, probably five. All of this stuff, you're going to get to write off in the year if you break it out. So like you could, anything that's less than 20 years.
And here's one of my favorite categories is that lawn and grounds. Some of those items, the driveway, the swimming pool, the retaining wall, can be very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all 15-year property, which means
you can write it off in year one. You change your accounting and you go to a cost seg, which I promise you, the only people that know how to do that are people that do real estate. You need to make sure that you're working with guys. Does bonus depreciation year one only apply after cost seg study is done and forms filed? You can go back to last year. Like we can actually continue. We could do a cost seg and make that election for 2019 all the way up until October 15th of this year. So, you know, 9 months in the future. Is that 9 months?
Yeah. And the whole reason for doing the 3115, it's called a change of accounting method, is I was previously depreciating my whole house using this method, but now I want to do it this way.
The way that it was explained to me that made sense is if I have a rental house and I buy it and it has carpeting, brand new carpeting, I know full well that that carpeting is not going to last 27 and a half years. But if I go under the default rules, I'm writing that off under 27 and a half years. And if I sell that house, that carpet is supposedly worth something. When we all know that if somebody buys a rental property, the first thing they're doing is tearing out the carpet and painting all the walls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why do we buy into that? Why do we let the IRS treat us that way? We just go in and, again, we have the option. We get to choose. And whether or not you try to write that stuff off really has to do with whether you have taxable income from the real estate. If you're getting into depreciation, it's offsetting all your income and you're just creating a loss anyway, then who cares? But as long as you're not a real estate professional or an active participant, you're not getting any benefits. So why care? But maybe you have other income. Maybe you have other rental income. And I'm saying, you know what? This saves me a bunch of money in taxes. So I'm going to do a cost seg study and I'm going to take this now. We've done webinars on cost seg. You can go to our website. done a bunch of them. And that's a huge, this is a great winner for people. Somebody says, if you put it in a driveway, do you still need a change of accounting or just write it off as bonus in 1 year without 3115? You have to do the 3115.
Well, actually you don't. For the assets placed in the current year, you're not changing that depreciation.
I see what you're saying. So walk somebody through this. So I buy a rental property and I put in a new driveway. You would just separate it out.
Correct.
And you'd write, and that would be 15-year property.
Right.
So I'd put it up.
But I would still need that. I would still want to do that cost seg.
But is it required?
I think it's an authoritative way to do it.
But if I've owned rental property, I've already been depreciating that property, do I not have to do a 3115?
Then you'd absolutely have to do a 3115 change how you're depreciating that.
All right. So I have to do it. Existing property that needs new driveway in year five. So it's year five. So you're going to have to do a 3115, and yeah, you do a cost seg study. Even it's not that bad. This is fun stuff. If you cost seg property this year, but it gets done before April, it's supposed to happen this week with cost seg authority. I know those guys. Eric Oliver's kick butt. He's a great place. We plan on 1031 this summer, and we do a $30,000 in rehab prior to sell. Can we do another cost seg immediately prior to the sale? Should we? No, you'd only have to do one. And when you rehab, it's really easy. You've already chosen to change your accounting methodology. Mm-hmm. And you have all your property broken out. So when you do the rehab, you just want to make sure that it's easy to classify the property. Then you're in like Flynn, Aaron, you're good. All right, let's jump in. We're dilly-dallying. How do we get to 4 o'clock already?
Wow.
Jiminy Christmas. Sorry, guys. We get chatty Cathy's. All right, I'm a resident of Oregon. I am carrying several notes on houses that I've sold, and I'm carrying the paper. I'm considering changing my residency. Would I have to continue to pay Oregon state taxes on these notes? So let's just say, are all these properties in Oregon? So let's just say that all the properties are in Oregon and you have notes on all these properties and you move to Washington where there's no state income tax.
Now, it can work one of two ways. If you're just writing the note for it and you've recognized all the gain when you sold the properties, then that's just an interest. And I think you can move to another state and no longer pay taxes to Oregon.
Mm-hmm. It's wherever that state treats certain activities. If you had a rental property, it would be taxable in Oregon. If you have a note, which is simply it's interstate commerce once you move to a different state, then I wouldn't be paying Oregon state taxes.
Now, if I sold my Oregon rental on the installment sale, Oregon's still going to want, or Oregon, or however I'm pronouncing it wrong.
Oregon.
Okay. They're going to continue to want their share of the capital gains from that property.
Chances are this individual sold that on an installment sale. Chances are if you're carrying back a note, unless they decided to recognize it all because they had a bunch of losses floating around out there, chances are this is somebody who's doing an installment sale. What that means, folks, is that instead of, let's say I had a house that I bought at $10,000 and I sell it for $100,000. I have $90,000 of gain. So I sold it to Jeff and I carried back a $100,000 note. That entire transaction is taxable right then in that year, unless I elect an installment sale, in which case, if I elect to have it treated as an installment sale, then let's just go this 10%, $10,000 basis. Mm-hmm. We'd have some depreciation we'd have to add back. We have long-term capital gains. Let's assume I owned it for over a year. So I had $90,000 of long-term capital gains. And then I have interest. So I have some money coming that I'm paying at or receiving at zero, some money that I'm receiving at my as depreciation recapture, which is capped at 25%. Some of it would come back at my long-term capital gains rate, which could be 0, 15, or 20%. And some of it's going to be interest, which is going to be my ordinary bracket. Hopefully your brain did just explode.
So every time I make you a payment, it's going to be divided up into different buckets.
Yep. And then yours is saying, hey, the interest portion would probably be taxable in Oregon, and the capital gains portion would probably be taxable in Oregon. And would the dividend recapture, that would be, do they state tax?
I don't think I would be subject to state tax. That would be wherever you're at.
Right. Is the interest taxable to Oregon along with the capital gain on the installment sale? If it's an installment sale, I believe that you're
going to. Yeah, I agree with that. I think they're going to say it's directly attached to those long-term capital gains.
Hey, I just got a really interesting one. And I'm so sorry, guys. I get sidetracked when I see really cool questions. For California rentals, can you use an irrevocable trust versus an LLC to own the property asset protection, then file form 1041 and do K-1s to do trust beneficiary? So, Maria, here's the rule, just because you perked my curiosity. What that means is that if you are filing as an irrevocable trust, it depends on where the trustee is as to whether the funds that are paid are taxable. So if the trustee is out of state, like let's say in Nevada or Delaware, then the income would not be taxable. But if you paid it out to the beneficiary, then it would be.
Yeah, California even asks on their state trust return, how many in-state beneficiaries, how many out-of-state beneficiaries, how many in-state resident trustees.
There's a really good case. Actually a really good case that just came out. I was totally geeking out with a trust attorney. So there was it was somebody famous, and it was their heir, and they had about $2 million in a trust that was making about $400,000 a year, but they weren't distributing any to them. And they had a California trustee and a Nevada trustee. And so half of that $400,000 was taxable because none of it was distributed to the beneficiary. But when it does get distributed to the beneficiary, they'll have to pay tax on the other half. If both trustees had lived out of state, let's just say you didn't have a California trustee, then it would not have been taxable at all. Yeah, well,
and that's crazy.
That's why people do these nings and dings. And there's brand new entity we'll be talking about called a statutory foundation in Wyoming, which I think is really, really cool. We're doing all of our due diligence. I'm talking to the drafters of the statute, and we're making sure it works for you folks in California. But California doesn't get to do the franchise tax on y'all when you have a grantor trust. And an irrevocable trust filing a 1041 is not what I would call a grantor trust. If you do an irrevocable trust, but you make it a grantor trust, then you get the asset protection with no tax from the franchise tax board, other than your individual tax. You still, whether you distribute it or not, you'd pay your individual any income, whether it's distributed or not. I'm not going to geek out anymore. I love that stuff.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
Let's go to the next one. Whenever I see Jeff's eyes start to gloss over, he's like, Toby, shush, then I move on. So where should property management business be formed? Wyoming, where I reside, corporation, S Corp, LLC, disregarded? Yes. You can have this one.
As far as a property manager is only managing the property. They don't own it. They don't have any employees there. So you can form that just about anywhere. And my preference is someplace like Wyoming, they don't have a corporate tax. They have good liability protection. And I would probably, for a property manager, I would probably prefer it to be a corporation because we can do a few more things with a corporation.
So, yes. And I'd be just, it's facts and circumstances. So I wish I could give you guys an answer. But if you have a management company, if you are a property manager, it's going to be wherever the property is located. We may set it up outside the state and register to do business there. Or if I want anonymity, then I'll probably set up a Wyoming entity, and I'll have it own an LLC in the state if I don't want to have my name on a public record. So I may have an LLC that's member managed by that Wyoming LLC that's taxed as a corp. Sounds long-winded, but keeps me. Let's say all rentals are outside of Wyoming, rentals in Phoenix or Washington, so Arizona or Washington. It depends. So the management company, you have two, and it really depends on where you're collecting the funds, whether you have another property management company doing it. So you actually have some choices here. If I'm dealing with the tenants and the properties are owned separately by the trust with an LLC, then I am probably wanting to keep my name off of that entity. I want to just act like I am the landlord, not the owner, but I'm just the management company. Mm-hmm. And then you can actually talk schmack about the owner. Nobody knows. It's funny how tenants will treat you differently if they don't think you own the property. Anyway, and the private managers are collecting rent, I'm just the asset manager, then you could be in Wyoming. You don't actually have to be there, and that's probably what I would do, and have the monies get paid to the out-of-state entity. You'd still pay tax on the rental, the profit. So, Jeff, like if I have a property manager and I'm netting it out and sending it to my LLC, I'd still be paying a little bit of tax in Phoenix and Washington, depending on what's obligated. Like in both those states, there's some version of a tax. Washington has the B&O and Arizona has the state. So I'm paying a little bit of tax on it, but I'm only on the net. So the management company is going to take its piece out of both of those.
In regards to what type of entity, I really feel like the corporation's the only one makes sense for tax purposes. Mm-hmm. Putting it in any kind of pass-through, you're just taking it out of one pocket and putting it in the other.
Yep. And so he's asking, this is somebody who's actually asking it, consistent. Rent would go to the LLC or go to the asset management company? I would probably have it go to the asset management company, take your management fee out of it, and then send the rest as though it was received by the LLC, just like a regular property.
Exactly.
Yep. And that will not change it from rent. It would still be rent, but it would only be the net rent, whatever you leave in it. And if you needed to pay more up to the corp, you could actually turn around and write it a check. But that thing, somebody says, what kind of entity is an EQRP? Is it the same as a 401k? Yes. Somebody just put an E in front of it and marketed it that way. There's no such thing as an E401k. Yeah, fun.
That's not in the code.
Nope. There's no such thing as an E, lowercase EQRP. But whoever invented that, I get that question like every time. They're a marketing genius. So I'm going to make one called a TQRP. It's a Toby Qualified Retirement Plan. All right. And somebody, by the way, somebody asked, they said we were asking the brother sister corporation question, and they had one of the businesses was a 501c3, and the other one is a company that they have employees in and they are owners. Yes, the no brother sister there, because there's no ownership in a 501c3. It's not owned, so you can't be discriminating. So it actually works really, really well. So yes, they're absolutely correct. Somebody had said that. And so when it's a corporation, we're assuming a for-profit, S-Corp, C-Corp, where you're an owner. If you have a 501c3, that's one of the ways away from the discrimination rules, because you are not an owner. You are merely a director. You're an employee. Boy, some people have some good questions. They're asking about Schedule A, and I'm so tempted to read it, but let's just keep going on. Can you have both a private foundation and a public foundation? Well, you don't own either one, but yes, you can control both. The private foundation's 5% donation to go to the public? Yes.
Yeah, and real briefly, talk about that 5% donation. The private foundation is required to contribute 5% of its funds to a charity.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say a private foundation and a public charity.
Yeah.
I guess it would also work with an operating foundation, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you can. So you have these, really, you have two groups. You have a pseudo group, which is a private operating foundation. But here's the deal. The private foundation is the most public charities are the most common. Those are the ones that are actually doing something. A private foundation is not doing anything except supporting public charities. And in order to get the tax benefit, the charitable donation, which is restricted, it's not as much as, I think it's half of the public charity. So it's public charity, you can give up to 60% of your AGI. Private foundation, you're going to be restricted down to about 30%?
30%, yeah.
Yeah. So in order to keep that, you have to give up 5% of its assets to a qualified 501c3. So the question is, can I give it to my public charity? Yes, if it qualifies as a 501c3. Yes, if you're not doing any conflict transactions, you're not trying to get shareholder benefit or something like that. But if you're running these things properly, then yes, you could do it. So I just put the caveat. So you can't just take the money and run with it. Somebody says nice things. So that's always good. And let's see. EQRP, by the way, is a proprietary QRP, but a guy named Damien, marketing genius. Hey, it's smart. Hey, I never knock anybody that manages to coin a phrase. You know, and here's the thing. In all seriousness, we need more people saving money in their own retirement plans. And here's the funny one. People are always asking me which is better, a Roth versus a IRA, or a Roth 401k versus a 401k. And the answer is, it's a push if your tax bracket isn't changing. But if your tax bracket is going to go down when you retire, it's better to take the tax deduction now and do a traditional. if your tax bracket is going to go up when you retire, it's better to do a Roth. But everybody knee-jerk reaction says Roth. When you actually run the numbers, if my tax bracket is 25% now versus when I retire and I have 30 years of growth, the same amount, it's exactly the same.
And I don't think people realize that just because I put it into a traditional this year, if mine don't have any income next year, there's nothing says, well, enough to make the contribution. But if I'm in a low tax bracket, there's nothing to say I can't start a Roth account.
Yeah.
And go back and forth as needed, or even put in both accounts as if you want to do that up to the $6,000 limit.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's the thing is when here's the deal. When you are in a really low tax bracket. So, for example, I have clients that will qualify as a real estate professional. We'll do something this year to take a maybe we'll cost seg. Maybe we'll take a bunch of accelerated depreciation. If you guys know what all that stuff is, maybe we'll make them get them down to the 0% tax bracket. Now I'm looking at them going, hey, if we're at zero and you have, let's just say that you even have a negative 100,000, you can convert up to $178,000 tax-free from your traditional IRA into a Roth. Now, the question is, do you think you're going to pay more than 0% when you retire? If the answer is yes, do that transaction. The answer is yes, guys. All right. So anyway, math is fun. Somebody says A times B equals B times A. Yes. But try to convince somebody that's been drinking the Kool-Aid of the Roth IRA. And yeah, it's like talking politics to somebody who's a rabbit on either side. Good luck.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, nothing, Jeff. We're not talking politics. I don't care how much you try. I can hear Patty cackling. All right. Is it too late to rent out your house for 14 days under the tax code? No, you can always rent out your house for 14 days under the tax code.
Well, yeah, if you and I had to think about this for a long time. If you mean for 2019, yeah, it's too late. The year's over.
Oh, right. Yes. If you actually rented your house, if you actually used your house, you could, you know, you're a cash basis taxpayer. So unless you physically move the money into your account, yeah, you're not going to get to write it off. You could still do it this year. But that 14 days is a section called, it's 26 USC 280A, big capital letter A. What it says is you can rent your house and for 14 days or less, it actually says less than 15 days. So it's 14 days or less and you don't have to pay tax on it. Right. That's why Airbnb people love to rent out their houses and have people sleep in their beds. It's weird. I always imagine that it's going to be some guy who comes over, and this is going to sound horrible, but I went to school in Europe in the middle of summer. Sometimes it smelled. So I always think of the most smelly friend that I had, and he's going to come over and sleep in your bed. And so that's what I always say. Think of the most stinky person, the guy that like never bathed or whatever, and they're going to come sleep and roll around in your bed. And that's what you're inviting in if you're doing the Airbnb in your house. So don't do that. See, I'm helping them.
Where I've really seen this 14-day thing work is, I know there were people in Miami who were renting out their houses for small fortunes that maybe they're paying $1,000 a month in mortgage and they're renting it out for $7,000, $8,000
or more. Then I'm happy to have the stinky guy. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to put plastic sheets on.
Oh, absolutely.
Over it. And I'm going to burn the sheets.
And the mattress. And
Anyway, if somebody says, wait, we need to write a check from the business to the homeowner. Yeah. Or if the money was already there, then you just need to reclassify it. So let's say I put a bunch of money into the company and it was a shareholder contribution, then I need to offset some of that contribution as a return to the shareholder. There's a way to do it in paper, but you're supposed to be reimbursing yourself.
And you should really be documenting what these meetings are about rather than just running for 14 days.
And somebody says, hey, I want to do this. I paid myself a $5,000 dividend. Can I reclassify it? Yeah, absolutely you can. But in fact, we'd encourage it. You just have to make sure you document it. Do I need to 1099 myself? No, because it's non, like this is actually a section of the code where you don't have to report it. So isn't that awesome? Would that be the same for meeting rents? Yeah, it's 14 days or less. So if you rent your, like this is what we usually see. You see people renting their house to their corporation at their corporate meetings, or I have a lot of clients that do MLMs or the real estate. We have clients all over the place. We have several, by the way, before you think crazy MLMs, I have many, many clients. I want to say like more than a handful making over $1 million a year and super than some of the nicest people you ever want to meet. it's because they're passionate about something, and maybe they're passionate about their product, and it could, you name it. If you're passionate about something, it tends to rub off. But yeah, you could absolutely have your meetings in your house, rent your house out. It's the fair market value. And yeah, you don't have to pay tax on it. I've seen it. Works great. And once a month. And can I do 3 in 1 month? Yeah, it's 14 days or less. So it's not it could be 14 consecutive days for all the court cares. All the IRS says is, hey, we have to follow the rules, and the rules say 14 days or less.
Yeah, you just don't want to hit that 15th day or it all becomes taxable.
Yep. And that's where we actually did this calculation with an Airbnb when people were doing this. When you hit about 15, 16 days, you go backwards. And in order to make up, you have to hit 22 days. So in English, 14 days is tax-free. 15 days, the entire amount becomes taxable, and it'll take you to about your 22nd day to make up all the tax you had to pay. So don't do that. If you're going to do, is it free estate tax as well? It's non-reported, Lily. It's an absolute deduction. So yes, it's state tax and everything. And that's, you guys can look it up. It's 26 USC 280A. I've been writing about it for 20-something years, and yeah, just go knock yourself out. We have a really cool 280A kit, and we've defended this one a couple times under audit. Just sometimes it pops up. It didn't trigger anything because there's no paper trail, but one was not even our client. We inherited the kind of a CPA's mess, and we fixed it. And that was one of the areas where we were able to get some serious tax relief for the guy. $79,000 tax bill down to $2,000, and it took about 2 weeks. Just because if you know how to classify things appropriately, those laws are there for your benefit. If you don't, then they're done. They're right. Still there. You just don't know how to take advantage of it. Hi, I will be 70 in April of 2020. Since the new law, and then she's talking about, or he's talking about, is it a she? I assumed it was a she. It's weird. Weird assumption. It might be a he. Since the new tax law allows to take the required minimum distribution at 72, then I don't need to take an RMD this year. And the answer is correct. You do not have to. And that's because the SECURE Act, which is saving every community for retirement or something like that. It's the weirdest acronym. You know what SECURE stands for?
I do not.
Saving Every Community Retirement Enhancement Act or something like that. It's weird. But it was passed in December 20th or 21st, where the president signed it into law at the very end of last year. This is one of the things. It raised that required minimum distribution that's required of traditional IRAs, traditional 401ks, and defined benefit plans. It raised the minimum age to 72. Now, here's the rub. You have to be 70 and a half in 2020. So if you'll be 70 in April, then you'll be 70 and a half in theory in October. I think that's right. And so you qualify. So you will not have to take a required minimum distribution until 2022.
So translate for the attorney.
Translate it, because I get confused.
Yeah. So if you were already 70 and a half at the end of 2019, then this does not apply to you. And I'll tell you what, they count to the very day.
Yeah. So if you turn 70 and a half in 2019, is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Yeah. Then yeah, you're toast.
So you don't have to take your first RMD till you're 72. Now, here's the other side of that coin that's really weird is they did away with you can't contribute to a IRA when you're over 70 and a half.
You can actually contribute to IRAs forever.
So let's assume I'm 72 and you're all typing out there. You can just stop talking about me being 72.
They didn't say you were 72.
So let's say I'm 72. I may have a required minimum distribution where I'm having to distribute some of my IRA.
They said 10 years ago you were
probably. So I may have a required distribution, which is taxable to me, mm-hmm. but I can also put money back into my IRA.
Hey, let's be twisted. Let's put money in our IRA and give the money that was required minimum distribution to a charity.
You can also, yep. You then can still do that with the RMD.
I would actually end up with a tax deduction.
Right.
But that's so much fun. This is like tax crack.
But there were a lot of new factors in the SECURE Act.
One of the things is you lost your stretch. Somebody asked this, are required minimum distributions still required for inheritances? Well, Ruth, that's an inherited IRA, and the rules are a little bit funky for a spouse or somebody who is actually older than the party they're inheriting from.
I think it's less than 10 years younger.
Less than 10 years. And also if it's a special needs child or somebody yes. that or under 18, Otherwise, it's 10 years.
Yeah, which is much better than the old five-year rule.
The five-year rule, but this is there's no stretch anymore. So it used Correct. To be, I used to be able to take it over my lifetime.
Right.
No more. It's 10 years, unless you're a spouse.
There's now, you're allowed to take IRA distributions to pay for birth and adoption expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Up to, I think, $5,000. It's still going to be taxable, but there's not going to be a penalty.
On that, too. Yeah. It's like $14,000 for an adopted child. Like, there's some pretty big incentives there. So somebody says, so if I take a required minimum distribution, can I turn around and reinvest it into the IRA? Well, technically, that's not active income. So you take the required minimum distribution, but you've also made a little bit of money. So you put some of the money you made into the IRA, then yes, you actually can.
Yeah, so you're still, if you're over 70 and a half, you're still going to have that earned income, either from W-2 or self-employment income or something like
that. And whenever I hear distribution being taxed, I'm so thankful that I have a variable universal life insurance policy that will distribute to me tax-free. That's there. And absolutely. And hardworking folks is a game changer. Yeah, we actually wrote a book on it. It's called The Private Vault. If you ever go to our website, you'll see it in there. People sometimes look at us and go, what are you guys talking about? And I'm like, it's protected. It's tax-free. I have three policies. I tell people all the time. I don't use variable. I use index simply because I got killed at variable when the stock market corrected. Index is a little more conservative and ratchets up, and you can't lose money no matter what the stock market does. And I happen to be a huge believer in them. I have three because I have one for a buy sell with my partners because my wife and daughter aren't lawyers. They can't be an owner of a firm. And it's just legally the way we're structured as a business, even though we do a lot of tax and everything else, it's still professional limited liability company that requires ownership to be a lawyer. So they can't. So it cashes them out. I have a key man policy because I'm one of the partners here. And to replace me, there's money that dumps in so they can hire somebody else. And then I have a regular one. And all of those I can borrow against if I need it. I can also use it if I need long-term care. And it's non-taxable. So if I want money, I do it. I used it for my daughter's education and for a car, as well as paying her into her company. So I always laugh, like I didn't hit any tax. In fact, it was kind of ridiculous. There's some years I got refunds back, but while my daughter was going to college, I was like, whoops, let's keep going. How many more do we have to go?
Three, I believe.
All right. What is the requirement by the IRS in order to qualify as a real estate professional? Now this is about a 2-hour response. So I'm just gonna give it to you guys in 2 seconds. So you're under 26 USC 469 C7. You can go read it if you want, 469 C7. And all this is to qualify as a real estate professional makes your real estate losses change from passive to active. And in order to qualify, there's a 2-part first test and there's a second test. The 2-part first test has to be satisfied by one spouse. So if you're a joint return, one spouse has to qualify. And I'll hit this in a second here. The first thing they have to do is they have to hit 750 hours. Second thing they have to hit is it has to be more than 50% of their service time.
Yep.
So whatever you do, that's professional services. If you spend 1,000 hours being a waiter, then you have to hit 1,001 hours in real estate. And it doesn't have to be your real estate. It could be your realtor, broker. It could be your construction person. You're involved in real estate. You're a developer. Doesn't matter. So that's test number one, 750 and 50% or greater. Test number two is I materially participate with my real estate. And it's a 9-factor test. If you hit any one of the 9 factors, you qualify. And when you're doing this factor, the time requirements, it's both spouses. So one spouse could qualify as a real estate professional and the other spouse could qualify for the material participation and you qualify for your tax return. Now, the ones I'm going to focus on, this is the absolute drop dead, don't have to worry about anything else. If you spend 500 hours cumulatively, you and your spouse, on your real estate, your rentals, managing it, handling your real estate, you qualify for material participation, period. Somebody says, what if you're not married? Then you both have to qualify. Then you would have to qualify. Each person would have to qualify on their tax return. But if this is a married filing jointly, then you add both spouses. There are two other tests. I manage my properties and I'm the only one who does it, then I qualify. If I manage my properties and I spend more than 100 hours cumulatively, so 50 hours for each spouse, and nobody spends more than 100 hours, then I qualify. And then you have a 5 out of 7 year and a bunch of facts and circumstance tests. There's 9 of them. I'm giving you the big ones. You hit 500 hours cumulatively, you don't have to worry about anything else. If you don't hit 500 hours and you're more than 100 hours and nobody else spends more than 100, then you're good. And then here's the last one. This is a per rental property test, unless you elect to aggregate them together. If you elect to aggregate it, it's something you do on your tax return. Guys like Jeff love to make aggregation elections. It's all of what? You check a box and write a little note. And you treat all of your activities together. And somebody says, what documentation? Any log will do, which means you can do it on a phone. You could be keeping it in a log. Just don't make it up at the end. Where people get in trouble is when they
like to use a contemporaneous word.
They want it contemporaneous, but it's not, I have to do it right now. They just want it to be correct. The people that get themselves in trouble are the ones where the hours physically don't add up. Like they do 2000 hours of real estate professional and they have a job where they did 2200 hours.
Right.
And the IRS says, there's no physical way you could have done that. And the court throws you out. They said, you're an idiot. Or you have, 300 hours documented for 1 month and nothing else on any others. They just look at you like you're an idiot. I am retired. Real estate is all I do. Do I still need a log? Yeah. Technically, if they audit you, you need the log.
You need to be able to prove your time.
So here's what I do. I tell people, keep track in your phone. Just keep a little Google calendar. And just pop in there. What did I do this week? Can you take a course and pass a real estate exam and then join as a real estate broker? Yeah, but you still have to do the hours. Being a realtor doesn't mean you're a real estate professional. It means that might be what you do and you have a really cool. How about being a capital raiser for a real estate fund? I don't know if that would qualify.
Yeah, some of those will qualify you for the
real estate,
the second test, but not for the first test.
Yeah, so if it's your fund, then actually capital raising, I don't think it's ever going to be, unless you're doing it for somebody else.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, so there's certain things that don't qualify at all, but shoot us an email. It's a fun one. We may throw that in as a question. What is included in calculating gain loss on the sale of a single family rental? Broker commission, seller paid, closing costs, renovation?
Yes. So basically it's what your cost, your basis is going to be what you pay for, less any settlement fees on both ends.
Mm-hmm.
Or I should say plus any settlement fees, cost, plus any renovations, anything you put into that property that you did not deduct elsewhere. And then whatever you sold it for.
And this is where the rub is if it's your house and you have a capital gains exclusion, then it just sucks because you don't get to write any of those off because you don't have any capital gains. If you have capital gains, then it is helpful, but it really isn't that great because you're like, it's capital gains. It's probably the best tax treatment you're ever going to get.
Right.
And so it's offsetting some of that, which is stinky. The deductions that are out there, just because some people will say like, hey, do I have to, is it lowering the capital gain or is it a deduction? The deduction is when you're doing a mortgage interest, that's deductible. Real estate taxes that you pay on your house, that's deductible. And that will offset your ordinary income at the highest bracket.
Right.
So we like those. This other stuff, maybe not great. And if you're 1031 exchanging, then it's literally just, you're never going to get that benefit. Like if you own it till you die, you're not going to pay any tax anyway. You got zero benefit from it, but you still track it. Can you be a real estate pro and on only one property? Yes, you could absolutely do that. It takes a trip 3 times to manage. Travel to your rental properties, I don't think is going to be included in your time.
No, I'm not sure about that one.
Can I claim myself on 1040 occupation section as a real estate professional? No, you wouldn't say that necessarily. I mean, you could, but realistically, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about making passive losses into active losses, and it's a special section. And then somebody asked, I forget what I was going to say. There was a question somebody had asked earlier, and I just completely blanked on it. Oh, I know what it was. Somebody was flipping, and they were wondering about the deductibility, whether something should be deducted as an expense. If you're flipping, it doesn't really matter, because technically, you're probably flipping within a year. If you need a deduction, like if you have a flip that was really good and you're in the middle of the second flip, you might want the, when we were talking about capitalized expenses versus ordinary, just like immediate expenses, you may want to take the immediate expense now. Will you respond to questions that you did not get during the webinar? Yeah, send it in. We answer them all month long. Send it to taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. We'll still answer your question. So we're here for, does all revenue in partnership have to be declared as income by the partners, even if some is left inside the company?
So in a pass-through, like a partnership, all revenue, all income gets passed to the partners, whether they take that money out or not. So the distribution really doesn't have anything to do with how much income you're going to have to report.
Yep. What Jeff said is absolutely right. These are safes that have money growing inside it, and you're being taxed on the growth inside the safe. Sometimes you don't even know what the growth is because it's somebody else is running it and you're just a passive partner, in which case probably in a couple of months you're going to get told what you made last year. And that's when you better have a diaper on in some cases, because some of these guys do really, really well, but they didn't distribute any of it.
Right.
And you're like, well, how am I going to pay the tax? Well, you better read your operating agreement and hope that it says that they have to distribute something, because this is where it's kind of fun. If you've ever had a creditor become an assignee interest holder in an entity, you know how much fun it is to give them tax bills with no money. That's the lawyer side of me just being annoying.
No, I've been there.
I think it's fun. All right. Free stuff. AndersonAdvisors.com podcast. If you want to listen to our Tax Tuesdays plus our other podcasts, by all means, it's free. Go on to AndersonAdvisors.com and listen. You can also go to iTunes. It's free. iTunes is free. And Google Play is free. All of our stuff. And here, I'll probably give you guys 2 seconds to see it. You can see there's lots and lots of different episodes. Those are from last year when I took the snapshot, but we always have new content. If you come and go to our YouTube page, for example, you have Coffee with Carl, you have Michael's podcast and videos, Clint's videos, my videos, everybody's videos. We're always sticking stuff up there because we're an education company. Everybody says, you're a lawyer. I'm like, no, I'm a teacher. And yeah, I happen to love working with real estate investors and business owners. And frankly, I just look at myself as an advocate. Jeff and I love to do Tax Tuesday. I think Jeff likes it.
Love it.
And it's so much fun to just answer questions. It's mind food. Then there's always the accountants. You guys should see some of the stuff we get. They're like, why are you answering stuff on a public forum? You shouldn't answer stuff. You know what? You stop it. Go back to your practice. Make everybody else miserable, right? I'm going to charge you for an answer. Come on, give some people some direction. We don't have to be stuffy. I think that the legal and the tax and the business professions changed a lot in the last 20 years, and it's so much more fun to put information out. We try to be as accurate as humanly possible. I'm sure we make mistakes periodically, but we're trying to doing the best we can with what we got. If you like, go to any of those Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter. Here's another one, Tax Tuesday, AndersonAdvisors.com or AndersonAdvisors.com. You can always visit us, ask us questions. And yeah, you guys are right. Some people said, hey, can I ask questions? Absolutely. Shoot it on over. And then just know that if you ask a really good question, I'll probably take it and stick it on one of these and we'll answer it live because other people benefit from it. So can I be sent the info on where to find those links? Absolutely. Susan will get that to you, Ruth, but I'm going to put it back up there for you guys. It's really easy. If you go to aba.link/Facebook/YouTube/LinkedIn/Instagram/Twitter, or if you go to our regular website at AndersonAdvisors.com/ and then just type in podcast or YouTube, like you'll find that we're pretty much creatures of habit. Everything's kind of the same, but aba.link/ and then any of the places you want to get to, you can see that we're easy to get a hold of. So if there's nothing else, I know there's a few questions that I may have missed. Feel free to email them on in. We're here to answer your questions. And I wanted to say thank you for joining us. It was fun as always. Yeah. Somebody just sent a bunch of links out there. I think Susan just sent it out there to you guys. And that would be so much fun. We could see you guys in 2 weeks and we'll do another one. Maybe we'll pick another topic. I think we did bookkeeping last week,
right,
which Troy did a great job. You guys have no idea, but Troy is a superstar and he hates talking in public. So he was like,
he did a really good job.
Oh, he did a great job. I give him a hard time. The next Tax Wise is on Thursday. And I think I shot out, and I'm going to put this up just because somebody asked. You can do the live cast on them all. For all of them this year. Here we go. There we go, right there. If you want to join me on Thursday and Friday, we're doing over 30 tax strategies. It's $247. It gets you both workshops this year. And we'll do all that fun stuff. And then how about details combining C-Corps and LLCs for business, not for real estate. So we can do all that fun stuff. We'll get into a bunch of, we'll probably do a retirement planning one and then a traditional business one and a few others this year just to keep it fresh. So we may hit you guys up for a little, for some questions specific to some of those things. I know you guys are already sending them in, but we'll do it. When are you doing bookkeeping? Bookkeeping we just did last week. Get that recording because it was really good. And I had chickens and swords.
Chickens and swords, you did.
Chickens and swords. You guys never thought you'd see it in a bookkeeping webinar, but you did. All right, guys. Thank you so much. And enjoy the rest of the week. Oh, Infinity. We'll send all that out. Debbie, Infinity rocks. We're doing one on April 18th, and we will send that out. I'm going to give everybody a freebie. You guys can all come to that one on live stream. We're not going to do it live, but we're going to do that. And we'll absolutely give it to everybody on this Tax Tuesdays for free. So we'll make sure that we get you guys a link. I'll probably shoot it out in 2 weeks. But just remember April 18th, I believe it's a Saturday. And we're going to do that. Bring everybody you can to that. We're really revamping it. We're really going to be knocking it out of the park. Just because for 2 years, we've been testing it to make sure everything's working. And we have a just about 100% success rate on people growing their assets inside of that. So we're going to keep spreading that word. All right, guys, have a great one. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.